Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 190 of Wheat All About It, or what I'm calling Douglas Poole's Badge of Honor, farming in North Douglas County. About my fascinating conversation with Poole, a farmer who found that third try's the charm when it comes to getting back on the farm. For those new to the podcast, please subscribe. On iPhones, simply click the purple podcast icon on your home screen, type Wheat All About It in the finder, and presto, subscribe. On Android phones, download any of multiple apps. I suggest Stitcher, S-T-I-T-C-H-E-R, type Wheat All About It in the finder, and presto, subscribe. Barring that, please follow the Washington Grain Commission Facebook page at Washington Grain. I post a description and link to each new weekly episode. Finally, you can also find the podcast and the complete archive of 189 episodes at the WGC's newly redesigned website at wagrains.org. But in that case, you'll be the one remembering new episodes are posted each Tuesday morning. I didn't know Douglas Poole personally before our conversation, but as they say in the movies, his reputation preceded him. He is a direct seeder in the beautiful but harsh landscape which bears his name. Unlike the deep soils of the Palouse, which were formed by volcanic ash and wind-blown soil, Douglas County is the terminal moraine of the Okanagan Ice Lobe. If you're not familiar with the word moraine, it's defined as a mass of rocks and sediment carried down and deposited by a glacier. It is land, Poole jokes ahead, where farmers from other harsh environments come to see just to be glad they are not farming there. But as steel is forged to increase its strength, to hear Poole talk about it, farming in North Douglas County accomplishes something similar. Certainly, it's an environment that demands farmers eke out every advantage. When I said Poole's reputation preceded him, I knew of him as president of the Pacific Northwest Direct Seed Association back in the 2016-2018 era. I had heard from others about the innovative things he was trying, including experimenting with cover crops, to good effect. I have to tell you, however, I am a bit of a skeptic about cover crops. I actually recorded an episode featuring a conservation district manager talking about them, only to have university researchers I trust tell me they might work in the Midwest, but not here. I didn't produce the episode. But I've got to admit, listening to Poole talk about cover crops has whet my curiosity. As he says ahead, he doesn't much like the phrase, "It can't be done here." Given the fact it took him three tries to return to the farm after graduating from WSU with an accounting degree, speaks to that determination. Longtime listeners know I complain when editing requires me to cut out valuable portions of an interview to bring an episode within a reasonable length. Despite my keeping an eye on the clock, Poole and I spoke for nearly an hour. And take it from me, that's not the way to produce a 20-minute podcast. Which is why I'm making Poole into a two-parter. And I still had to cut a lot. Criminy. You'll hear Poole ahead use the term "weed it." For those who don't know, that refers to a sprayer designed to only spray weeds in a field. He also talks a lot about his uncle, the godfather of direct seed in northern Douglas County. That's Tom Poole. I asked Poole, who grew up on his father's wheat farm, what he was witnessing as he came back to the land for the third and final time in 2011.
Gosh, obviously, no-till was starting to be discussed. There were, in North Douglas County, there were a couple of farmers that had really had played with it for a number of years and were beginning to make it successful. It wasn't really until around 2009, 2010, I've got an uncle who kind of became the I guess we call him the Godfather, but he just kind of became that guy that was doing the research, was driving around, carried his shovel and was looking around to see really how it could be improved and it fully implemented in North Douglas County. You know, watching him, his son, he works for Syngenta and had been to Australia. And of course, you know, Australia, I considered them to be about 20 to 30 years ahead of us from a dry land, no-till implementation process. And he came back and said, hey, there's the whole place is no-till. They do it with 4 inches of rain. You know, we're crazy if we don't think it won't work here. And so that's kind of how that all looked. So it was a significant change. You know, I didn't come back going, oh, I'm going to go no-till. My dad was a very successful farmer and he did quite well with what he did. And so I didn't come back with that in my mind, other than my interest was piqued. You know, what could that look like? Obviously, in North Douglas County, when you look at our equipment comes here to die. And so we have a lot of it and a lot of it's old, it's welded, it's kind of duct taped together just to put up with the rocks. And I do remember thinking when I drove up one day thinking, man, I'm coming back to all this. And I never was a good welder. I was never much of a repairman. And so all of it came together and played into what it was. But that was the biggest change, obviously, to go from conventional to no-till. And that was going on before I got here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When did you know that direct seeding was the answer you were looking for?
I'd have to say, upon reflection, obviously watching my uncle, who farmed right next to us, and then I went into NRCS, and I just would have to say and go on record, we have the coolest NRCS, I think. And I just remember going in and sitting at Erin's desk, and she basically said, "You're going to do this. This is the way farming is going, and I'm here to help you." Ray Archuleta, I'm sure you've heard his name. He's Ray, the soil guy for NRCS. He's now retired and doing quite well with his soil health coaching. We got into an exclusive meeting with him, 30 of us, in Colfax. And so we all got up at 4 o'clock in the morning and drove down to see Ray, the soil guy. And I was hooked. You know, he just made it seem simple. You know, and it obviously isn't, but I was hooked.
All right. All right. Now, is there anything that you specifically have brought to the direct seed dance? And by that, I mean, how did you refine and perhaps improve the direct seeding practice on your farm?
It would be hard to say that I did anything. It's fascinating about my journey and the journey of North Douglas County. It just was a group of us that all decided to go at once. And so we were all driving to our soil health meetings and to conferences, and we just ended up in each other's fields. It was nothing for me to get in trouble for being out till 10 o'clock at night. And I was usually with my uncle digging a hole somewhere, you know, looking at what went on. And so by no means, I suppose at that time, did I have anything to do? Where I diverge now is there's two of us in North Douglas County that are fully implementing cover crops, and that's because we have cattle. And so when you look at the soil health principles, the five principles, they all end up needing a cow. And so we've kind of jumped off the deep end and believe covers need to be here and need to work.
Well, we're going to talk more about cover crops. But first, if I had to use one word to describe farming in Douglas County, it might be rocks. How do rocks change your practices, or do they?
It obviously changed it from a no-till standpoint, trying to find a piece of equipment that would handle the rocks. And so that, you know, we settled on just a couple of different pieces of equipment. It's fascinating what will put up with the rocks in this area. I bought my uncle's drill. He retired here just last year. I believe that drill has 60,000 acres on it. And, you know, for the most part, we do some welding and some other things, but it's putting up with it. But I would have to tell you, anybody would laugh if we really sat down and talked about this, but the rocks are a good thing around here from a no-till standpoint. We're obviously glacial. We have a bottom to our soil. And so I liken it to a bathtub. Our moisture really can't get anywhere as long as we've got some sort of cover on top, some sort of residue or obviously a cover crop. I'm good friends with a lot of people from Ritzville and down through those areas that, you know, they do struggle because that moisture will, you know, it'll suck down a foot and then not come back up until they get some cooler weather or some moisture.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting. I've never heard rocks as a benefit.
Yeah, everybody kind of chuckles when I say that, but it wasn't me that came up with it. It was a friend of mine from Ritzville who just, you know, I was talking about, God, we just don't ever have any trouble with our moisture going away. And he goes, well, you goofball, you're farming in a bathtub. Your moisture can't get anywhere. So.
Okay, so most farmers in the summer fallow area of the state are using a rotation that follows fallow with the winter wheat crop. Now, agronomically, it may not be the best, but economically, it is. And in such a price environment that we have now, isn't economics the best measure for farmers?
That's what in my case, that was what I was conditioned to believe. And obviously, there's some big drivers in that. Our bankers, our creditors, you know, my wife, my family. You know, in the end, I suppose in any industry, what is the bottom line is did you make a profit or did you not make a profit? And through this, in my case, in this journey, one of the things I came to realize was, look at one of those drivers. And what I just mentioned was my creditors. Well, my creditors are my equipment dealer and my chemical and fertilizer dealer. Those are the two big ones. And through the journey of soil health and everything that I've come across and everybody I've listened to and everybody I've read, you can do it without a lot of that input. The price of wheat in Waterville, so Waterville's the home office for Highline Grain, I asked them what the average price of wheat was, how far could they go back? And they could go back to 1976. The average price of wheat in Waterville delivered is $3.98. That brought my brain to a complete halt. I'm thinking, wow, you know, this passion that I had to come back to all this, and that's what I have to look forward to is $3.98. I'd never looked at it that way. And so if you can't control that, which I'm not a believer that I can control either the market or the price, then what is it that I can control? And I can control that expense side. So yeah, to answer your question, we are conditioned. I don't want to say we. I don't know how other farmers think or whatever else. I was conditioned to think that I had to raise the most wheat, and I believe there's another way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now you have an accounting degree from WSU. How has having an accounting degree helped the farm?
Everything's on a spreadsheet. You know, I've got a million different analyses that I do, and kind of goes back to your last question. All of that analysis, and I spend a lot of time chasing, how can I improve fuel efficiency? How can I improve chemical use? How can I reduce fertilizer use? Those are all things that, you know, it takes me away from thinking about, well, geez, if I would just work with the soil and work with what Mother Nature gave me, this might be a little easier in my case. But I would have to tell you, upon reflection, what my degree at WSU got me was I couldn't depreciate out a factory in Pennsylvania, but it kind of teaches you how to be a lifelong learner. I didn't coin that term. I obviously, when I worked in the education industry, you know, that's all they talked about was you got to constantly be learning. That's what we got to be teaching the kids. And I think one day I came home and thought, well, geez, you know, we're trying to teach the kids. I need to continue to be a lifelong learner. And that's served me quite well in what we're trying to implement here on my farm.
Okay. All right. So can you take me through your farming practices over the course of a year or a rotation? And And also include in there what kind of fertilizer and chemicals that you are using, and are you using less than somebody else, let's say.
Yeah, again, not knowing what kind of how everybody else farms, I have a general idea of people that are no-tilling. But, in my case, obviously, we harvest and then in the spring, we begin to fallow. And so I would love to tell you that I have a system implemented over all my acres. I do not. And so just into my normal farming practices, we fallow. And then, I come with either winter wheat or winter canola. We have began to grow a lot of oats, a lot of sunflowers, just trying to get some diversity in that rotation. And that's on a majority of my acres. That fallow process obviously includes a chem fallow, where we use Roundup and a 2,4-D or Idicamba of some sort. I would have to tell you, I did make the investment in a Weed It. And so we've cut our chemical costs and our use by, right now, this year, I'm running about 55%. Other guys are seeing more savings. I swear you have every time you have a wreck somewhere, I've got a couple of fields that we just don't seem to hit right. And so we've been back a couple of times and I increased the type of chemical I use, obviously expensive chemical to get that weed. But that's what that normal process looks like, or my normal rotation. I don't even like calling it normal anymore, but that's where I'm at with the majority of my acres. My other acres that we're trying to we're implementing the cover crops, in that fallow process, the cows are out on the fallow the whole time. And so I've got four fields this year, roughly 1,000 acres that have only seen chemical twice this year. The cows have taken care of the weeds. And fascinatingly enough, a residue, whether it be canola or wheat, is an issue at seeding time in a no-till system. The cows are actually my mechanical coulters. They either eat the stubble off or they trample it enough, and I'm not having to implement a mechanical process with the cows.
Tell me about your philosophy when it comes to cover crops, given that they suck moisture out of the soil, and moisture is what gives yield.
Well, in my case, in all of this, I just flat call it a soil health journey. The five principles, no disturbance, you got to keep something covered, you got to keep a growing root, you got to have cattle integration and some crop rotation. And so the way I began to think about that was, and I'll stop and make another comment, and people hate when I say it, but I'm going to say it anyway. I struggle with it won't work here. Because Mother Nature works here. If you look at bare soil, in a couple of weeks, she's got a diverse mix of weeds. We call them weeds because we're farmers. We can't have that. But Mother Nature heals itself, and it's a constant cover crop. And so when I look at that, I'm like, well, if Mother Nature can figure it out, why can't I just mimic that? But that, this is so people that question the practice, the next thing they'll say was where's the yield in that? Again, you asked about accounting. I'm kind of a numbers guy. As I go back and look at all the yields with everything that has been done with chemicals and fertilizers and breeding and everything else, and the yields have not increased. In fact, I've got fields where yields are declining. And so we're not getting anywhere yield-wise with what's going on from that standpoint. And so when I read and I see, I've seen all this on my own farm already, when I can know that if I work with nature, I can do it without all of those inputs and have a better, probably a more nutritious or a more nutrient dense product from that standpoint. A better way just to tell the story, I had a landlord meeting where I had all my landlords in the room, had all but one. And I told them, I said, you've asked me to farm, you've entrusted me with your farm, and here's what I want to do with your farm. And I told them that what I wanted to do was stop and make an investment in the soil, because up to this point, I didn't believe I had ever made an investment in their soil, farming on their behalf. I'm a miner at this point in time. I infuse synthetic fertilizers and chemicals with a, sometimes a genetically modified crop, be that canola, I take that crop off, which is removing carbon. You know, I'm just a miner. I just take. And I told him where I saw the soil health principles taking us was much like painting the barn. We stop and we put brakes on the pickup. We stop and we paint the barn because we know we need to make that investment to move it into the future. And that's how I see it is I may not have yield in 1 year, but the investment I've made in the soil and the soil biology with a diverse, I actually don't like the term cover crop, but a diverse mix of a cover crop, a more mimicking nature, we're making that investment for the future in that soil. Because even with the no-till system, that was something that I noticed right off the bat was we saw, you know, organic matter levels, gosh, 0.1%. You know, we've seen that happen. And, you know, I've been no-tilling since 13. The needle is not moving fast enough. I'm not a very patient person. And you're just not going to move the needle with these systems if we're going to, in my case, on this farm, if I'm going to continue to just be a monoculture wheat fallow system. And so I implemented no-till. That I don't know that that's going to get the soil so my son can farm it, you know.
Douglas, there's an idea that cover crops actually create their own environment in the field, perhaps even drawing on dew in the air that would be lost in a fallow field. What are your thoughts?
I've seen it. And of course, my own brain got in the way. It's like, I immediately thought, well, all that moisture's there. What am I going to do with it? And that's really where I'm at in my journey is what do I do with all that moisture that I, you know, we managed to manufacture is what it looks like to me, because I've had cover crops. So I've let them go to full term, not on purpose, by accident. We missed them with the sprayer or everything else. And it blew my mind to see that the moisture was right at surface level. The plants were robust. And like you said, they were dewy. And the first thing I did was with my uncracked brain was I went out and I sprayed it out, and the moisture flat, it turned those areas into concrete. And so that's where we're at right now. The first thing that I've done in my case is I've tried to eliminate that thinking that I've immediately got to get a crop in that. And so that's where the cows came. Really, the cows come in, and I now fully understand why they say a true soil health system has to have livestock, because the you know, again, nature needs to be mimicked with the moving of that livestock and what they bring to the soil and how they interact with the soil. And so I'm letting my covers grow longer, and we're putting cattle in that. That is one of the ways that we're mitigating that lost revenue of the cash crop, or that wheat crop in that fallow system is if we can graze 2-3 different times, and we've done that, and then we've either hated or taken the triticale to cash crop, we're not making, by no means are we making the same money we would be with the wheat crop, but we've made that investment, and it's that investment that we're seeing.
Now, you know, you're talking about the cattle that you brought back into your farming practice. And I got to say, I think a lot of today's wheat farmers see that as going backwards because, you know, there's a 365-day nature of caring for cattle. Tell me a little bit more about the practice with cattle. And I mean, is this something that you think everyone should go to? And of course, everyone can't because there's not that many cattle.
I had the good fortune. I knew cattle had to come back, and I was raised with cattle. And my very, very good fortune, the farm that my dad took from his uncle and that I have the good fortune of farming now, literally the gates could be open from the ranch and the cows could be on the river above Wells Dam, you know, in a half a day by themselves. And so that's kind of how I grew up. Was, you know, everything was weaned and everything else. And and everybody was turned out, and they showed back up when the snow started to fly because the gates were open. You know, even back then, the wheat was grazed and everything else. So I knew I could do it, but I quickly learned how much I wasn't a cattleman. And so I had a neighbor who happened to be a cattleman and would tell you himself that he was a cattleman and not a farmer, but he did both. And so one day, you know, I had actually asked several people. I had interviewed one guy. I asked a cousin. I had been down several avenues trying to find somebody who could come back and run the cattle side of it that knew way more than I did, which was just short of being able to spell the word cow. And went to this particular neighbor and found that, you know, he Alan Savory is one of the people I follow, a holistic manager of livestock. He believes that that's the way we need to basically regenerate the world and save the world. That's kind of his mantra. And when I went to ask this particular neighbor if he would be interested in letting me play with some cover crops and him put his cows on it, you know, I was at his place, and I happened to glance down at his desk, and he had an Alan Savory book, and he had attended all of Alan Savory's courses in the late 70s, early 80s. And so I'm telling you, I got lucky finding who I found to implement the cattle in what I was trying to do with the farm ground.
You have the advantages without the disadvantages of having to take care of the cattle.
I do, you know, and so that's it's easy for me to say, hey, cattle got to be implemented. I would tell you it's fascinating. I've got a neighbor who watched, and he went and partnered too. In our case, I'm the farmer and they're the cowboys, and that's how we know each other when we talk about each other, when we interact. And cowboys, it's nothing for them to go out at 4 o'clock in the morning and throw up a hot wire, and they don't think anything about it. And I would look at that practice of putting up a hot wire, thinking of all those posts and everything else and springing the wire. That's just what they do. They know that that's part of their system. And so we now have, I would have to tell you, probably not a quarter. We will be by this fall of our farm ground is hot wired. And that was all basically two cowboys and a couple of their kids.
Well, that's a pretty fine testament to hard work, isn't it? It's not part of my system, but I'm glad there's cowboys to do it. Perhaps the song from the musical Oklahoma is correct. The farmer and the cowman can be friends. Then again, it's not always easy finding cattle, let alone cowboys these days. I've always been fascinated not so much by direct seeding, but by the philosophy of direct seeders because they really think hard about what they're doing. There's no auto steer to the way they puzzle out their farming practices for sure. At the same time, Poole understands that he's in a fortunate position to experiment, or as he put it, to make an investment in soil. Other farmers have barriers to such changes, including landlords and bankers, among others. We'll talk more about such things, as well as how CRP impacted Douglas County, in episode 191, or what I'm calling Douglas Poole's Badge of Honor, Farming in North Douglas County 2, right here on Weed All About It.
We're all children of a special treat, a miracle of nature that we just call wheat. A crop that's in the Bible, a crop that's in our bread, a crop that's filled our bellies and held us in good stead. Through a history of starvation and times of want and woe, wheat has been our savior, our grub, our gruel, our dough. There's always lots of problems when we have enough to eat. But there's only one dilemma when there's not enough wheat. We feed you.